Welcome to the High Existence Podcast. John Brooks here. Today's interview is very special. Sometimes you meet people in life and they seem almost like mythical characters from a story. They've done something that doesn't even seem possible. Me and Eric Brown speak with someone who fits this description. That person is Dominic Milton Trott, the author of the Drug User's Bible. Dominic says on his website, "The first casualty of war is truth, and the war on drugs is no different." The Drug User's Bible is a step to counter this destructive situation. People are dying. They are dying because of ignorance, because unremitting propaganda is denying them essential safety information. The Drug User's Bible cuts through the noise and misinformation of the war on drugs and documents the facts about the individual drugs and the subject in general. End quote. Dominic self-administered over 150 different chemicals and botanicals in the writing of this book. It took over 8 years. For each of these chemicals and botanicals, he documented the vital safety data, which included the dose thresholds, the onset times, and duration, as well as trip report, a subjective analysis of his qualitative experience, usually at different time check-ins. Among the most well-known drugs are LSD, crystal meth, Xanax, DMT, cocaine, GHB, spice, phenibut, speed, magic mushrooms, cannabis, and opium. I sat down with Dominic in this interview to find out why he wrote this book, the journey that he went on. And then we go into depth on the best experiences that he had, the commandments of safe drug use that he refined over the years. We talk about the worst, most traumatic drug experiences that he had, the metaphors that he uses for psychedelic transformation. Dominic's perspective on drugs is incredible. If you are a psychonaut, or you're just curious about taking drugs, or you have taken drugs, or you're thinking that you might take drugs, or you just want to learn more about this subject, this 1 hour and 45 minute conversation covers a lot of ground. I found this to be incredibly fascinating, and I couldn't recommend the book enough either, The Drug User's Bible. But without further ado, this is me and Eric Brown in discussion with Dominic Milton Trott, the author of The Drug User's Bible. So my first thoughts when I started looking at your book, The Drug User's Bible, was just like, wow. Like, that was my first thought, like, what the hell is this? This is incredible. On so many levels, like even forgetting the actual information that's in it, which is super incredible. Mm-hmm. I was astounded that you actually, like, one human being did this, because like ideas like The Drug User's Bible can start like, I've got an idea. I want to try all the main drugs, and then I'm going to document them systematically. And like, maybe someone will get to like drug three and then stop, you know, like you actually did the whole project. Yeah. So let's start at the beginning. Just like, I think it's a good place to start. How did The Drug User's Bible come about? Like, what was the beginning of it? Why did you decide to start that project?
It started when I really got bored with working. I was sort of working on the internet. And then I'd had enough, really, of work. I had enough sort of, I wasn't rich or anything, but I had enough money to get through to retirement. And I always had a sort of life plan that I wouldn't carry on working just for the sake of it if I didn't want to do it. So I started doing various humanitarian missions, and that involved the internet and YouTube and so on. But while sort of pursuing some of that, I started asking myself questions about well, what do I really want to do this? What do I want to do? What's the meaning of life? The sort of stuff you get that you ask when you're getting on a bit in years. And I came across a video from a few different people on ayahuasca, one in particular by Terence McKenna. And I thought, well, I'd really like to try that, not just curiosity, but what does it give me? Will it give me a new perspective? I might learn about life and why I'm here or what's, you know, I just thought it would expand me and my consciousness as a person. And that was before I used words like consciousness. After a while, I sort of got comfortable with the idea of I'll go and try this stuff. I'll go to Peru and to ayahuasca. But I didn't want to go there and never having had a psychedelic. I had had LSD in my 20s once, in a fairly weak trip. I didn't want to go there completely naive. So I decided, well, what I'll do is I'll try a few of the legal psychedelics in this country, because at the time, everything was legal, unless it was specifically scheduled. So you had all the research chemicals and various plants which you could import without any problem. So I tried 1PLSD and a couple of others. And I documented the dose and just wrote down what I was doing. The day came and I went to Peru and had ayahuasca, just missed a little bit, which is quite important. While I was doing the research for 1PLSD and the psychedelics, I got a lot of information from forums. And anybody who's frequented the forums will know that sometimes people disappear. Word does come back occasionally that they made a mistake and they died. And I noticed this, and I noticed it across quite a number of forums. It was reasonably common at the time. And that was distressing, because I conversed with a couple of these people. And it suddenly occurred to me that, well, actually, there are websites, but there isn't actually anything that people can take away from the internet. So I thought, well, somebody should do something. And I didn't have a book in mind. I had a spreadsheet in mind. Somebody should do something, create something that was portable. I really thought it through. But the day came, I went and had the ayahuasca experience. And that sort of catapulted my confidence. And I came back believing, not instantly, but after a few days, a few weeks, that I visualized a book, and I believe that I can do that. I had this belief I didn't have previously, that this if it was a mission, I could actually accomplish it if I actually set about it in a rational, planned way, if I approached it rationally and carefully. So I sort of started expanding the spreadsheet and had a few other legal highs, research chemicals. And then one day I thought, well, I'll convert this to Word, because it was just impossible. It started becoming unusable and untenable to actually look anything up on Excel. And sort of, I could see the doses and the onset times and the short bits, but the sort of anything in terms of my notes about the experience, it just wasn't working. So I transferred it to Word, and immediately I thought, this could be a book. Mm. This was 9 or 10 years ago, I don't think I was fooling myself at any stage that it was going to be a long haul and it was going to take a lot of time and effort. But as I sort of accessed the forums again and started expanding beyond the psychedelics, I really became more determined, because people were continuing to disappear. And the more drugs I actually, and I'm not talking 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, you know, the more drugs I actually experienced, the more confident I was that it should be done, and it could be done, and I could do it. I never looked back from that point. I sort of got into it. I planned forward and decided how I was going to take the drugs, in what order I was going to take the drugs, because one of the sort of safety precautions I mentioned in the first chapter was, you know, if you're a multi-drug user and you're taking different classes of drugs, then it's probably a good idea to sort of split them up and have a psychedelic, then have a stim, then have a sedative, and then have a dissociative, then have a, and rather than having three stims on the bounce, you know, so I sort of worked all this out really early on, and some of the other generic rules which changed as I went forward. But really quickly, I became absolutely convinced I could do this, absolutely determined to do it. I never even thought that I wouldn't, from about 3 or 4 months into the project.
And how long did the project take, like from the moment you started taking it seriously to when you kind of thought, like, this is complete now, this is done?
Probably about 7 or 8 years. It was probably 10 years from when I first decided to do ayahuasca, to take ayahuasca. And it's probably a year or so after that, 2 years. So probably about 8 years from the moment I envisaged a book to the completion of the book, which was I finished it in 2017. That was an early sort of, with 140 drugs. But I wasn't happy because, 140 drugs is a lot, but I realised that there were good reasons for some of the drugs I hadn't taken. But the more I thought about it, the more I realised that, well, if someone somewhere is taking this, and it's not one in a, 10 million, it's the drugs that you've heard of and drugs that kids talk about, I've really got to do this, whether I think, there's Datura, for instance, the sort of advice I would have given with Datura would be, don't do it. But I sort of, that's not going to convince anybody. So I decided when I finished the first version that I have to do the two. There were various opioids, and I was originally going to just do one or two. But I thought, I should do a sort of really good cross session, like I've done with all the others, because opioids are not really very exciting from my point of view. So there were good reasons I haven't actually done the drug. DXM was another. DXM's a dissociative, it's cough medicine. And I always considered that to be a sort of dirty dissociative. And I somehow envisaged it as being a sort of messy ketamine or a messy ephenidine. And the reason I decided to do that apart from the fact that it should be, because it's fairly well known, was the fact the first thing, the really serious piece of advice that people who are considering using that need to know is, check what's in the cough medicine apart from DXM. Because quite often it's the other active ingredient that can cause significant damage. So straight off the bat, there's a very, very serious of harm reduction, piece of harm reduction advice. So I knew I've got to do that. So, I finished in 2017. I thought I'd finished, but then I did another 2 years to actually do 14 other ones. And expand the final section to cover welfare in a more comprehensive manner.
Wow. And how, over those years, how much sort of energy did it take from you on a weekly basis? Was it something that you did full time or sporadically, like broke it up into mini projects?
No, it was constant. The problem I had was I had to When I'd performed an experiment, when I'd taken a drug, I had to make sure I was totally clean before I did the next one. Because, I was actually reporting on a drug. I had this in the system. That's not good enough. So I had to wait usually at least a week before I actually tried the next experimenting with the next drug. So it was all mapped out. That's one of the reasons it took 10 years. Some of them had to travel, been to every continent apart from Antarctica to actually take drugs. because it wasn't just the fact that some drugs aren't obtainable in here or in Europe. It's also that where I could easily do it, I would take it in an authentic, traditional setting. You know, I always preferred and tried to do that. And I'd take a drug here if I couldn't do that and it was legal. And if it wasn't legal, I'd tend to go to Amsterdam or somewhere else to do the experiment. So, you know, it wasn't just get all the drugs in and just line them up and take them. It took quite a bit of planning and effort to actually get through them all. So it was a dedicated mission.
Yeah, I can imagine. Circling back to the ayahuasca experience, both me and Eric have worked with ayahuasca and found it to be like really useful. Can you tell us more about how that was? Like, what was the experience of the ayahuasca, and how did the ceremony or ceremonies go in a way that gave you more confidence to pursue this project?
Well, I think it was the typical ayahuasca ceremony. And you know, I had all the shamans and I lay there and vomited in the bucket because it was very common. It was Ethnicus in Cusco, and it wasn't what I was expecting, because I'd only had sort of LSD and 2Cs and. Not quite what I was expecting. It seemed to go on for a long, long time because I had the cut and everybody else was vomiting, but I wasn't. So they came and offered me a second cup and I said, yeah. So I had to take two cups to everybody else's one. And eventually, very quickly, it kicked in. And what I think happened was, you know, I started having the ayahuasca experience, and then when that was wearing off, the second beaker, because it came in this big plastic beaker, kicked in, so it sort of went wobbly for a bit, and then re-emerged later when I was out of the ceremony. Really. So the main thing for me, I found it tunable that I could actually go into the experience and come out again. I wasn't expecting that. You know, I thought it would be like a DMT and be in it, and that, you know, that was it, and that was a surprise. But I think this doesn't just apply to ayahuasca. I think it was the aftermath that had the bigger impact. I think you know, I went in and had these experiences, and I was getting messages which I thought are valid. But it was after, you know, I was happy for days, longer than days, which really didn't really have a care in the world. I felt really good. But it was the assimilation of the experience that had the bigger impact. Because I don't know, somebody, this isn't my metaphor, but and I can't remember who stated it like this, but you know, until that point. I was like, you know, most people sort of are on a journey through life and sort of trying to imagine it's a train ride and you're going in a straight line narrative. Thoughts ticking over on a straight line and you're on a train and you're chugging along and you're looking through the window and your life is in the train. A serious, heavy psychedelic experience like ayahuasca. In this metaphor is you step off the train onto the station and you see the train from outside the train and then you get back on the train. Once you're back on the train, you don't see the train in the same way ever again. And I suppose the other metaphor is a goldfish getting outside a goldfish bowl and then being put back in the goldfish bowl and realizing it's water. And that changed me. I think that was what gave me the confidence to do the book. Because I was less sort of, you know, head down. This is my sort of, you know, I knew what high consciousness meant at that point. I started researching O'Leary's 8-circuit model. And it was a change. And I think it was largely because I'd been out and I'd experienced something outside normal five sensory organ reality, I saw normal five sensory organ reality in a different way, and it was less sort of serious in a way, but serious, but not as, you know, I wasn't as frightened of it. I wasn't as worried about society or socially what people would think, and all these sort of culturally mandated fears were gone. And that was down to the ayahuasca experience, not the DMT, not the drug, but the actual experience, because it is the experience that changes people. Mm. There's no physiological or biological difference at all after a few days. It's the experience you've had actually does change. If it's not a non-drug experiences change people. Mm. But it just happens to be a very intense, different experience to come to terms with. But the assimilation, for me, it changed me dramatically in terms of, you know, what I felt I could do and should do with my life, what I felt I was capable of, and certainly fear. You know, at the very start, before this, I was, oh God, you know, I was like everyone else. I've been had a lifetime of war on drugs propaganda thrown at me, and it has an effect. Mm-hmm. And I think that was that sort of fear was dismantled largely through that trip to Peru, and I was able then to sort of focus on this project I was doing, or thinking about doing, and playing with the Excel spreadsheet, and thinking, taking it seriously in terms of this can save lives, and you know, there's absolutely no reason why I shouldn't do this if I can do it, and this is really what I've been looking to do with this sort of searching period after I sort of decided to stop purchasing money and working. So it was that sort of experience that through, you know, just removed all the chains really, and the fears and the concerns that I naturally had at the very start of the exercise, and sort of released me to actually take it as seriously as it needed to be taken to complete it.
And a sense that I get from your book that you just touched on is that you clearly have a mission about risk mitigation and safe use. You know, it's not just a collection of, you know, interesting. It's not like just a coffee table book where it's just like, here are some facts about drugs. There's actually a strong mission behind it. And did that come, as you said, from going on these forums and seeing like deaths that could have been avoided?
It was for, I mean, I'm a mathematician. I've got a degree in mathematics. So you're going back to generations, obviously, a long time since I did mathematics. But one of my roles before I moved into working on the internet was I was a security, IT security consultant for a bank. And that was about risk analysis, vulnerabilities, controls, impact, and how to measure and get the appropriate controls for the particular scenario or situation. So I sort of applied that mathematically applying, but sort of in the back of my mind, I applied that to what I'm seeing on the forums. And I was sort of remember sitting there thinking, this guy, he overdosed because he did whatever it was. He overdosed because he eyeballed it and he didn't measure the dose. And he most likely didn't even know the dose. This other guy double dosed because he didn't know the onset time. You know, all the common mistakes. So I'm sort of looking at that and think, well, you know, these people aren't idiots. They're articulate, and you might sensible posts on forums. And I could very often read exactly where they'd gone wrong. I thought, well, there isn't really a comprehensive work for people like a lot of these fatalities, people who suffer these fatalities, available in book form. They really should be. And that was the driver. I thought that I could actually rationalise it and actually put organize it. So I saw the organization of it really at the beginning, and that was the sort of generic approach to drug taking, the Ten Commandments of safer drug use in the first section. These really are the sort of procedures, this is the process you should apply to any drug. But obviously for each drug, you do need to have the doses and the information on duration and so on and so forth. So actually envisioned the book as it stands immediately. And I think that was all relating to my background as a sort of risk analyst for a bank, because I was, well, there's the risk, control is these countermeasures if it goes wrong, you know. So I was sort of putting it all together in quite a logical and rational way. It all came together very quickly in terms of the concept, and the organization came together very quickly after I got back from Peru.
When you say that you have a degree in mathematics, the book suddenly makes a lot more sense, because it definitely is very structured, and I mean that as a huge compliment. One of the things that I was pretty astounded by was your subjective reporting. And I was just wondering how you did that, because I was reading the methamphetamine one just before this call, and it's like every 15 minutes or so, there's like an update. I'm just wondering how you were able to do that. What was the process? It
depends on the drug. Some drugs, that's not possible to do. But most drugs, it is. What I decided to do was, you know, what one of the safety factors for a lot of drugs, one of the safety issues for a lot of drugs is actually, what is it like? And it sounds, oh, it's just funny, it's entertaining, it's a trip report. Well, it's more serious than that. I think, you know, you need to know when you're taking, not all drugs, but some drugs, how it's going to affect your judgment. You know, is your judgment going to be impaired to such a degree that you do stupid things, you take too much? Mm-hmm. Are you going to fall into a compulsive redosing binge and lose control? Are you going to be safe in a public place or not? You know, all these issues you can't sort of quantify in terms of dose, you have to describe the experience so that people can actually read the experience and understand, this is where you're going to be if you have this drug. So I knew that the subjective experiences were essential, and they were an essential part of each drug. And of course that immediately mandates I have to take each drug. I can't just, you know, put figures down for a drug and that'll do. It won't do. I had to take each drug for that reason, and I had to report on it. Now, I tried to structure them, depends on the drug, but, you know, the same background, this is what the drug is, this is where it came from, this is a bit of history on it, no sentence, nothing. And then I tried to work out, am I going to be able to do a sort of captain's log for every quarter of an hour or half an hour throughout the experience? And by and large, that's possible to do. And by and large, I did that. And, you know, crystal meth, ice, I did it for that as well. And you know, that gives you an idea of how quickly it really takes effect. You know, you have it and then 2 minutes later you're out of your tree. Or do you have it and then it sort of gradually comes on stronger and stronger? Or is it a drug that you usually be redosing with to a degree? And how I did it, I used a pen and paper, because I wasn't always sat at here. I did a lot here, the legal stuff that I could import if it's a plant, or get hold of if it was a legal high. And I just, you know, make sure that every 15 minutes or whatever was appropriate, I'd actually just write down, how am I feeling? You know, am I okay? Are my eyes, are pupils dilated? Are my eyes a chaotic? If I'm high, how am I high? I'm stimulated, I'm sedated. And I try and write at various time slots where I actually was in terms of the experience itself. Now, that's not always possible. I mean, it certainly isn't with some of the psychedelics. I mean, Changa, that was one of the ones I did that I sort of thought, oh, I'll record. I started trying to do that, and of course, I couldn't do it because it was an incredibly strong experience, and it came on very quickly, and I didn't even know what a pen was. So, well, I did, but I was just too sort of engaged with what was happening, especially when I stepped out of the sort of building, out of the room, and everything was wow, you know. So I had to write that one retrospectively, because it just wasn't possible to record it during the experience itself. Well, most of them, though, I actually kept the sort of the formula of record this whilst you're actually undergoing the experience at various time marks and at the end, never forget to record what the night's sleep was like, what you felt like in the morning, because they are quite important from the harm reduction perspective. Some are, I mean, there's a class in the book of dream herbs, and you know, you can't write them as your sleep. So, you know, in that particular case, I'd write it first thing in the morning.
Yeah.
Whilst it's still fresh in the morning, so that wasn't through it. So it largely depends on the drug itself, but I did where it was possible, which is in the majority of cases, I would do a captain's log of all the way through.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people like to, for recreational drugs, like to do other things while they take drugs. So music, interacting with other people, going for walks and things like that. Did you pair up things? I mean, I'm guessing that would have been kind of difficult because you had to be kind of objective and scientific. Like, how did you manage that? Did you do other things when you were doing the drugs, or did you just sort of sit there and with a?
It depends on the drug. Right. Most of the stimulants I stayed in, and I tried to sort of really, really, really concentrate on it. And I think the said is, but some drugs, you know, if I'm traveling and I was experiencing the drug in the authentic settings, or
yeah,
you know, or doing the museum dose in Amsterdam, or you know, I would by its very nature be out and I'd have to try and somehow, you know, sometimes took paper with me and a pen, depending on what the situation was. But by and large, I tried, and this is really difficult to do sometimes,
mm-hmm.
for some drugs. I tried to genuinely focus on how am I feeling, what am I thinking, what do I want to do, put music on it, is that enhanced in any way, what's it like, is there any increased libido or sexual urge, you know, do I feel like interacting with people, is it empathy enhanced? So I tend to go and try out different things. But the focus will be, I'm having this experience, and these sort of tangents or some throw-offs are short, and I'm going to come back and record it, rather than the drug being incidental to the experience, because you know that wasn't the point, you know, mm-hmm. that I didn't want the drug to be incidental to the experience, I wanted it to be central to the experience, and I could measure what different activities the experience of those were like whilst on the drug and not the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
I think I did that fairly successfully generally.
One of the one might think that one potential difficulty in this experience of writing this book would have been if anything was so nice that or so enjoyable that you would have wanted to do more of it and potentially derail the project. So if you had an amazing experience on one weekend, you know, would you have wanted to repeat that the next weekend, for example? Was there anything like that, any particular drugs that you had a hard time saying no to afterwards, or that kind of tempted you to derail the project, or were you just really disciplined throughout the whole thing?
There were drugs that I would have carried on taking indefinitely. Crystal meth is one of them. I mean, I was going to take 50 milligrams of crystal meth, and I bought 100, and I had 92. So I ripped off for 8 milligrams. But he was more than enough. So I'm going to have 50 milligrams, which was, according to all the research, was more than enough. That was a good dose, heavy dose. But it was so good that I just kept going and kept going. Got to me 92. If I'd have had 292, I would have carried on and had it. And these are the realms of these sort of 72-hour binges. Mm-hmm. Where people just don't sleep and they're wired for 72 hours. And that would have definitely been made for methamphetamine, which you mentioned earlier. But one of the, you know, I got 100 milligrams for a reason. And that was either sort of, I would usually have a sense of what class of drug is it, what sort of drug is it. Is there any chance it could be a compulsive redosing or so addictive that I can't stop? And if that's the case, one of the sort of Ten Commandments is set your upper limit by availability. Mm. You know, set your limit to, obviously I'd done that with 50 milligrams, but also make sure you really, really, really upper limit that you can't just go out and get some more of it. And I meant that to the degree that, you know, I actually took it in a different place to where I procured the drug, so that I didn't have a supplier anywhere that I could get hold of it from when I actually took that drug and some of the others. So, you know, I was sort of limiting what I could do with some of these drugs by making them unavailable if I needed any more or wanted any more. In the short term, so that was a sort of constraint and a harm reduction limit that I used, what method I used to limit the dose, and that was needed. It was needed on that in that case because it was just so nice. But you know, I have to counter that with the blunt truth, the hard truth that it takes back, and it took back everything it gave me with interest.
Mm.
You know, the next day I was like a car that had lost its oil. I'm sort of cranky and just felt completely empty and drained. And I could feel my brain as an organ. It didn't seem to be working. And I just felt down. And the day after that, there was no joy in anything. The day after that, I was still, so it took a long time to actually get back to the baseline where I could actually derive pleasure from the normal things in life. I can't remember how I worded it, but you know, I said, you know, if you're a multiple doser on this and you have it regularly, I can fully understand how people, you know, have a terrible life and die from addiction. It's just horrifically hard because. And it's worse than, you know, people mention addiction to cocaine. It's much harder bite than cocaine and most of the other stimulants. It's just really, really great, but really terrible aftermath. And of course, the aftermath is a good thing in many respects because, you know, at the end of that, I'm like, there's no way I'm having that stuff again, even though it was such a nice experience.
Yeah. I think you described it in the book as being like a nightmare or a living nightmare or something like that for people who are addicted to it.
I'd read all the sort of articles. You know, I listened to one of these and I only had 100 milligrams of it only. You know, if anyone's watching this, you know, don't have 100 milligrams. It's far too much. Mm. But you know, I'd read all these stories and how people had ended up killing themselves suicidal because they were so depressed and they couldn't get any pleasure out of anything. And they're all the truth. You know, this isn't... The problem is when, you know, there's been so many lies so much misinformation with the war on drugs, so much exaggeration, that it's hard to actually tell what's right and what's wrong, what's true and what's false. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you can read articles and propaganda that are decrying the terrors of the most benign drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, you know, it's very easy to sort of read something that is true and not believe it. And that was another sort of, I felt it was a pressure really that I had to do the book. It was because people who wouldn't listen to governments, and probably rightly most of the time, but wouldn't listen to sort of authority type organisations or, you know, they might listen to the guy that had 157 drugs. You know, there's a certain credibility that you like to get the truth from a guy who's had 157 drugs and has described them all as accurately as possible. You might actually get the truth if he's saying that, you know, don't have methamphetamine because it's so easy to become addicted and compulsively redose. You know, he's probably telling the truth, as opposed to, you know, the government who will say terrible things about every single drug. And you've no idea whether it's the truth. So, you know, that was a sort of idea I had about the book. But, you know, if I'm telling the truth and being completely honest with every experience, then there's a chance that people will actually take harm reduction seriously and follow the procedures. You know, if I'm really, really trying to stress to them that with this drug, you've got to be really careful in this respect or that respect.
I thought it was interesting about what you said about meth took away from you more than it gave you, even though it gave, you know, give you a lot of pleasure. And yeah, I think a lot of people think that drugs are dangerous because you can OD on them. And, you know, they're dangerous because of the experience of taking them. And yes, of course, 100%. But you just made me think that they're also dangerous because of the psychological after effects of taking them. You know, people could potentially kill themselves or, you know, just do stupid things because of, you know, emotional issues that come from come downs and things like that. So I was just curious, you must have had quite a few low periods during writing this book.
I had low periods. I had traumatic experiences, which I'll come on to. Low periods. In this section, I just have one page in the first section, which is the introduction, and I think it's titled What Goes Up Must Come Down.
Mm-hmm.
And what I try to explain, and it's difficult to say, it's better to show diagrams, but I've got a diagram in there, you've probably seen the graph, whereas most drugs, and I have to take psychedelics out of this because it doesn't really apply to psychedelics, but you know, opioids, stimulants, sedatives, they tend to work in that you start at a baseline and time zero, and you take them because of this bit where you're going up. Alcohol, you know, great, you know, going up, and then you tend to have a plateau. It can be a short one or it can be a long one, but eventually you come down again. And at some point, you go under baseline. And it can go deeply under baseline and come back quickly, or it can go deeply and come back slowly. You know, it's like a mathematical graph. And each drug has a different pattern. They always start to go up, they come down, they go under, they come back to normal. So it's like that, mm-hmm. as a sort of graph. You know, and, you know, the sort of payload of a drug is you're actually getting this bit at the bar. That's what you want. And you're paying for it with this bit under the line, further on, you know, and every, not every drug, but most certain non-psychedelics, most drugs are like that. And, you know, the common ones, alcohol, it's great for an hour or two, it depends how quickly you're drinking. But then, you know, the next day, you know, a terrible hangover, in which case you've gone well below the line. And then during the day, you'll sort of come up. Maybe the next day, you've not quite got to baseline if you've had a heavy session. And it's this sort of, the sort of how much is there underneath the line and how much is there above. And I find that, you know, certainly at my age where, you know, I don't want to lose 3 days out of my life because I've had a lot of alcohol or a lot of this drug or whatever it is, you know, you look at that and you just look at the picture and I don't want to do that. That's just not a good exchange. It's not a good deal. So there's usually a law, and you know, if you're going to have a drug experience, one of the factors to consider, not just really the direct overdose or harm reduction type issue, is do you actually really want to do this? If you actually fully consider what you're buying and what you're paying for it in terms of the experience and your life experience. So that is important. It's something to bear in mind when you are having all these other drugs, non-psychedelics usually, non-dissociatives perhaps. So there is that. But the other, I mean, it's probably a separate topic, the traumas. Do you want me to? The traumas. And this is partly mistakes, but not entirely mistakes. There have been occasions where and there's a couple related to psychedelics, one related to psychedelics, but not a psychedelic, where I found myself lying in bed in fetal position, thinking I've really done it this time, or occasions in which I thought I'm shocked, I'm going to die, or I might die. And I'm feeling really terrible. And am I ever going to recover from this, or what? And I'll just, like, three different sorts, really. One, the first bad experience I ever had. This was when I was young. This is what stopped me having drugs, because I'd had cannabis, alcohol, this low experience LSD. Then I had fourth drug, nutmeg. Nutmeg's a deliriant. And I can see Eric laughing in the background there. you know what's coming. I'd read in a tiny book by Adam Gitberg, tiny little book called Legal Highs, that nutmeg was a legal high. So I had nutmeg. This is nutmeg that you put on cake and food. So I'd made this tea with this nutmeg and I drank it. And about 2 hours, nothing happened, and I was really disappointed. I could have gone out drinking tonight. Mm-hmm. So I went to bed about 2 o'clock in the morning, well, sometime in the middle of the night in the morning. And I woke up and everything was spinning. Everything was bright, different colours. I needed to go to the loo. My head was hurting. I felt like I was going to vomit. So I sort of got out of bed. I couldn't walk. I just crawled on my hands and knees. I put my hands onto the sort of wooden floor, and it looked like it was going into glue. I had to pull my hands out. It's all wobbly, and I was really seriously unwell. I got to the toilet. I couldn't go to the toilet. I couldn't pee. So I got in bed next morning. I'm still ill. I was ill for days. I honestly thought that, you know, I permanently damaged myself. And it's a delirium. I didn't know what a delirium was at the time. I just thought I was going to have a trip. So the message there is delirium, so I'm not psychedelics. So that was a traumatic experience. And that put me off drugs for 20, 30 years. I didn't have any more drugs after that. Because it was just so horrific. Other experience, I had a bad experience with Mapacho, which you'll be familiar with it in as an ayahuasca ceremony. I bought some, so I had some anyway, but I went to Vietnam and I was on the streets of Hanoi. Vietnam happens to be the only other country where this is in common use outside South America. They call it Thiac Lao. And I saw these guys on the street smoking bamboo pipes. And of course, straight away, I've got to have whatever it is. I'm gonna have that. And I had a sort of feeling that I think that's my patch on. So on the last night, I had a couple of beers, and I'm going to ask. And I went to a gang of about three guys. I said, "Can I have a talk of you? Your bong, I'll pay. You know, whatever the local dollar was." They said, "No, sit down. I won't take the money." And they sat me down. And I took a picture of the packet photograph so that I could actually afterwards find. And I'll tell you what the mistake was in a minute. so that could actually identify it later on. And I took one talk of this thing, and it was like I'd sort of sucked in the exhaust fumes from a car from the exhaust pipe. It sort of felt so artificial and chemical, and I felt dizzy, I felt ill, I was gasping for breath, trying to get oxygen. And this went on for about 10 or 15 minutes, and I'm sort of there, and they thought this was quite funny because they'd obviously done this to other stupid tourists as well. And eventually, I was okay to sort of go, but I kept having to stop down the road, and it was a horrific experience. But you know, it was at that point I sort of realised, well, now about half an hour after the event, I feel a certain clarity. You know, it had completely got rid of the alcohol out of my system. You know, I didn't feel like drinking or anything. I felt quite good at that time, but to get to there was a nightmare. And what I'd done is this was another mistake people made on the forums occasionally. They'd be a first-time user, typically an opioid, and they'd have what the buddies were having. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the buddies have got huge tolerance, and they've got none. So, you know, and that was the situation in Hanoi. And I don't know how, you know, with all the experience, I was so naive and stupid about this, but I just, all these guys everywhere smoking this stuff, it never even occurred to me that they had all this huge tolerance to this theatrical, and I thought I could do the same, and I couldn't. So that was horribly traumatic. Another was the artificial cannabinoids. Now they have had an interesting life, at least over here. The first one was, and they only emerged because cannabis was illegal. So chemists came up with these drugs that were a bit like cannabis. Mm-hmm. First one was called JWH0018. And it was a bit like cannabis. It wasn't as good. It wasn't as sort of, it was just, it had features of cannabis. And it didn't smell like cannabis, and it lasted quite a long time. And it was, you could go get it from the shops. So they made that illegal, and the producers produced JWH0045 or something similar, which was slightly different. They made that illegal. And there's this cat and mouse game going on. So then comes another iteration and another one. And each step along the way, the drug was becoming further and further removed from cannabis and more toxic. Mm-hmm. So after a few years, they were producing absolute monsters like 5FAKB48 and AM220001. And these were quite a long way removed, and I tried these. There was one in the interim which was okay. And I tried it once, it was fine, it was a bit like JWH, not as good. And I tried it a second time. And I sort of fell into a pit of despair and paranoia. Yeah, I know you can have a degree of anxiety and paranoia on certain strains of cannabis, but honestly, that never, not in the same ballpark. It was horrific. And that's when I'm upstairs in the bedroom, lying on the bed, thinking I've really done it this time, you know, sort of praying for the end to come, but at least knowing that an end would come. And I remember one of the things that went through my head was, you know, if I didn't have that light at the end of the tunnel, if I was some 16-year-old kid, say, with no experience, and I'd have this stuff, that, you know, I'd probably think maybe this is how we'll be forever, you know, and that could easily cause permanent psychological damage. You know, I kept on top of it simply because I knew through experience what it was, and I'd done the research, and I knew it would end. So I was sort of thinking, oh, how long have I been in this? 5 minutes? How long to go? 5 hours. But at least, and it wasn't that long, as it turned out. It was a long time. It seemed that. So that was a situation in which sort of experience got me through, but it was horrific. And I had a similar one with AM2201, which was another artificial cannabinoid, which was popular at the time. So they got a situation which was created and driven by governments banning cannabinoids and cannabis. Mm-hmm. Cannabis and for producing a market for these drugs that would never have existed if the simple plant cannabis plant would have been legal, and that was an absolute nightmare. Mm. I've had two or three other, and I've had the sort of experiences that people have on, you know, a magic mushroom trip. If you find yourself in the middle of a city, it can be overwhelming. You know, they're not traumatic; they're just difficult. So, you know, the difference in these are that they were really sort of debilitating. I was thinking, you know, I wish I hadn't done this. How can I get out of it? How can I get better? When's it going to end? Am I going to be all right after this? Those sort of thoughts and feeling terrible while the thoughts are there. Feeling ill, head hurting. You know, almost like terrible flu and just suffering badly. So there were experiences like this on the way. Not that many, but some, and they're documented in the book because they have to be. Yeah. So, you know, there were some of the flip side. It wasn't all, you know, what a wonderful experience and the payback. There were some terrible experiences.
Yeah,
and then the payback as well. So it was straight under the sort of line into negativity and then not actually coming back for a long time.
When you describe that experience being curled up in the fetal position, wanting this to end, to someone who's never experienced what you were going through, it could almost sound like comical, like, you know, like that. But unless you've actually been there, it's hard to really explain to someone how difficult that must have been, where you're counting down the minutes to get out of your own head.
I mean, I don't, you know, I pick the words carefully in the book.
Yeah.
And there are drugs, you know, experiences like that, which were trauma. And I was traumatized because nothing else mattered. I didn't want to die. Mm. And death was, you know, for some of those, death was, I thought, was a possibility when I was under the influence, and you know, it was the other thing. You know, some of it's thought. You know, the other thing is am I going to be permanently damaged? You know, by this, am I going to be permanently changed? Have I done something to my brain that's going to impair my mental capabilities? And you know, this is going through your head, and it's simply because, you know, there's certain drugs like that do produce paranoia and anxiety.
Yeah.
And so with such power, you know, that, you know, you can't escape it. You know, you think, well, I've had all these drugs, I've been not, you know, honestly, you're sort of in there. Anything you think about, you know, with the 5-FKAB48, whatever subject I thought about, I would find a sort of negative, horrific spin to put on it. Oh, I'm going there, but they're coming for me. What if this happens? And it was just, you know, words are sometimes difficult to find to describe just how deep that sort of pit of despair and fear can be. Mm-hmm. And I've been in that, and I wouldn't want others to do. And that's why, you know, with the nutmeg and with these artificial cannabinoids, the book isn't there to say don't do drugs. Mm-hmm. You know, the book is there to sort of explain, you know, if you've decided to do this drug, you know, this is, you know, you've got to be aware of this, this, and this, and this. And don't take, you know, this is the dose that people normally, you know, all the stuff they need to help them navigate it safely. But I've done all that and done it also for nutmeg and these drugs were in which I suffered so badly. You know, at the end, I do say, you know, well, you know, you take this drug, to not make any deliriant, Datura, this applies to as well. you take this drug and you actually gambling your life for an experience you probably don't even want to have.
Mm.
You know, so I'd gamble, I'd have this thing, and sort of the experience itself, a delirium state is one which is by definition close to death. It's what happens when you're seriously ill. So it's not somewhere you want to be. So, you know, all these kids who are playing with Nutmeg and Naturi, you know, what are you thinking? Seriously, because, you know, I'll tell you what it's like. You don't have to do it. Just read the book, read that section in the book. That's what it's like. And mm-hmm. Seriously, you do not want to be in that space. Just so you can say you've had it, or just because you're feeling brave. You know, you really don't. You know, just read it. And it's the truth. I think to the degree the artificial cannabinoids, that sort of snuck up on people, because it was a sort of stealth. The first artificial cannabinoids weren't so bad, and they just got worse and worse and worse. And people got sort of suckered into taking these drugs, and before they knew it, they were addicted, and they were having these terrible experiences, and they were out in the street in a major cities. It was just horrible, and it was caused by governments, the drug policies, and lack of information. Again, nobody was aware when they were buying these colourful packets, you know, what was actually in them. And sometimes, you know, very difficult to find out what is the active chemical in this drug that you happen to have called Black Mamba or something similar. Lack of education, lack of information there. But yeah, you know, sometimes you can get in a space that is not just uncomfortable or difficult. It is truly traumatic. For some people, it could be cause lasting damage without a shadow of a doubt.
I really like your use of the word traumatic here, because there is research coming out now with certain drugs being able to heal trauma, you know, like MDMA with PTSD and psilocybin, and, you know, ayahuasca is known for helping people with trauma. And I see two camps of people. On one side, it's like, you know, the people who don't know much about drugs and they're just like, drugs are bad. And then on the other side, you actually see people almost like glorify them too much, like any difficult experience is just you working through something. You know, like it's only bringing up trauma that was already there. And it's actually like, no, any, as you said earlier, the experience is the thing that changes you, both good and bad, and you can have an experience that can traumatize you even on a drug that you might think can help. So yeah, I appreciate that.
I think an example of that is Salvia divinorum. At the time, and I'm sure you're probably aware of what it is and how people use it, you know, very, very few people have a good experience with it. The way we take, I mean, it's supposed to be chewed, quidded, and that's how the natives use it in Mexico. In the West, it was extracted, Salvia divinorum was extracted from Salvia divinorum, then sprayed on some plant matter and smoked. Became, you know, very, very, very strong, 20 times, 100 times the native strength. And you smoke this stuff and immediately everything changes. You know, Kansas has gone bye-bye. But it's not in a nice DMT or trippy sort of way. It's trippy, all right, but there tends to be this negativity to it, this sinister edge for most people. It certainly was for me. And when I first had that, you know, I thought, oh, that was terrible. Especially as I had it, by, I thought it was a cannabinoid, so I added to it. But I had that experience, and I repeated it because I thought, well, it's because I didn't know what I was having. So I'd sabbed it on the second time, and it was still horrible. It wasn't traumatic in like the other, but it was scary, negative, no fun. And at the time, I thought nothing, got nothing out of that at all. I just thought that was just a bad experience. It was only quite a long time after I started to think about it more and more, that I did get something out of it. And it was a step up that train again. A step out of this into some other place, and then back. It was a sort of a power boost of being able to see things differently and widening perspective and so on and so forth. So I think over time I did actually accrue some benefit from the salvia, even though it was a bad experience at the time. Now that's probably an extreme example of how people have used, you know, bad trips with classic psychedelics, but still managed to derive positivity from it. I think psychedelics are a wonderful medicine for all sorts of uses, and it's appalling that they're illegal. But certainly stepping off the train is one of the I think that applies to virtually everybody who has the mystical experience, if you like, on a psychedelic. You know, everybody does benefit from that, even if they pretend they don't. I think it's just that widening perspective changes you as a person, because you've got more experience and enhanced wisdom, because you've seen more, learn from it, even if you don't mean to.
Yeah, I really like that stepping off the train analogy. That really rings true for my own experience as well. You mentioned just now about you think that psychedelics are a wonderful medicine, and you mentioned the word legality. I was wondering if there are any drugs that you've taken that you are like, this should definitely be illegal, and if there are any that you are like, this should definitely be legal, like, or anything like that.
I think they should not be legal, because, you know, by once you take them out of, you know, the legal framework, once you put them into the hands of the criminal underworld, if you like, there's the classic arguments that you don't know about the quality of the drug itself. But, you know, you're also pushing education away, because, you know, people comment. One of the problems with this book for people who are nervous, a nervous disposition, is, oh, drugs are illegal and can I be seen buying the drug users Bible? Now it's saying, dare I educate myself? Because I'm if I have this book, or I'm seen to have this book, or be interested in this, or in the process of education, I'm telling the world I'm committing an illegal act. So, you know, straight off the bat there, by making a drug or a set of drugs illegal, you de facto created ignorance in terms of harm reduction and safer use. And that's where the problem we have today, and why so many people are in trouble and are dying, because, you know, the information that should be pushed onto them, it shouldn't be just say no and so on. It should be, well, if you're going to take a drug, it's not really, we don't think you should, but if you're going to take a drug, here's the information about that drug, and this is honest. It's the dishonesty that is so damaging. Here's the honest information about this drug, that it's the truth. Now, nobody wants to kill themselves unless they decide, you know, an actual suicide. Now, people who die of drug overdoses aren't setting out to kill themselves. They're making mistakes, and they're making mistakes. Even if it's complacency, you know, one of the rules is, you know, don't be complacent, go through this process. Now, some of the mistakes I've made were complacency. You know, I've had too much of some drugs and had a sort of difficult experience because I had too much, or I've made a mistake in some way. And a lot of it's complacency. Oh, I've had this drug, you know, and you just habitually, you know, eyeball it because you can't be bothered. And so a lot of it is, if you just tilted it from prohibition to education, okay, well, you can get hold of all these drugs, you can take them, but here's the risks with this particular drug. It's an addictive drug. And by the way, you can believe me because they're now legal and it's the government telling you this and we don't lie anymore. So it is addictive, and here's the dose. You have too much. This is what you must do. You must test it to make sure it's actually this drug and not a stronger analog of this drug. It brings the entire canopy of education and harm reduction information to the public domain. And I don't think I'm different to anybody else in that when I took drugs all the way through it, even in the very, very beginning, I actually did want to know what the dose was. And I did want to know how long it took to take effect. And I did want to know how long is this going to last. And so, you know, I think people who take drugs, certainly for the first time, do want to know. They do want accurate information. They do want to know what it's going to be like. I think everybody does. And it's just so difficult to actually get that information, you know, especially if you're not on the internet. Get that information quickly, get that information, you know, and have the confidence in the information itself that, you know, it's true from drug to drug. So I think making drugs illegal would, you know, or flipping it around, the fact that they're illegal, can it get any worse than it is now? Hardly. And, you know, you look at the places that have legalized possession, Portugal, for instance, and it has a dramatically positive effect in terms of public health. It's, you know, the evidence is there, even if other governments choose to ignore it.
Mm, yeah, beautiful, beautiful answer. I have a few more questions, but I just wanted to check in with Eric in case you had anything that came up for you so far.
Hey, thank you. I think this is really beautiful work, and it's extremely important. You know, what's come up a few times is it's almost an aspect of like willful ignorance. It seems like the chain of reasoning is like, well, education doesn't matter if it's illegal and you can't get it anyways, right? Because you don't need to know something you'll never have access to. But it's apparent that that's not the case. Everything that's had the war on drugs start with it has actually gotten orders of magnitude more potent when it was illegal, right? We saw that with alcohol, and like that's how a lot of what would it be called, high proof alcohols came into being. Same thing happened with cannabis, right? Doubled in like extreme strength increases because it was illegal and you needed smaller amounts to get the same thing, blah blah blah. And so it doesn't hold weight. And you know, I love these kind of citizen science projects, because you're basically like filling the role that our governing bodies or our health organizations should be stepping into in a way. Like this should be a government mandated initiative, basically.
It shouldn't exist. I mean, this book shouldn't have been necessary.
Yeah.
It's only here because there's a war on drugs and a war on information. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned at the start that you know, it's almost willful, and the problem is, it is, and the reason I say that is, this book is on harm reduction, yet they won't accept adverts for it on Twitter. It's been banned. Adverts on Reddit, banned. There's a video, 1 minute video of take harm reduction seriously, flashing 50 drugs in 1 minute, and at the end, don't skip the safety measures. So it's like a public service announcement, banned from YouTube. Instagram account for the book, banned. Yeah. So you've got bunk police have these, you do these sort of tabs to check, is this fentanyl or is it heroin?
Yep.
There are adverts on Twitter, banned. On Facebook, sorry, Facebook banned them. And, you know, you sort of think, what the hell are you doing this for? How can you possibly justify banning a book that is dedicated to providing life-critical information to a group, a section of the population? you know, what is wrong with you that you're actually doing that? And, you know, it's just, it's the word drugs. It's stigmatized to such a degree that, you know, that they, or if it's drugs, we're banning it without even the slightest consideration of what is it they're actually banning. They're not having an effect. The drugs are there. They're not selling drugs. It's vital information. It's book burning, basically. And in the case of the bunk police situation, you know, people need that product to avoid taking fentanyl and dying. It's a frontline resource.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to actually keep people, lots of people, ignorant of the fact that this exists to help you is, you know, criminal, isn't it? It's appalling. So there is a sort of willful element edging around there that, you know, these are the drug users. Don't matter. And it's there, an undercurrent of it, and it's absolutely appalling.
Yeah, and it's not even that they're just not given platforms, but there's actually legislation that suppresses the efforts. There's some legislative acts, at least here in North America, I'm in Canada and in places in the States, where it's actually illegal to have harm reduction services at festivals because it acknowledges the consumption of illicit substances. And yet, you know, those same things where those things are banned, you have body bags walking out. And it's like, well, that was entirely avoidable. And so which one would we rather have? And again, the reason I say it's almost willful ignorance is because, like, it's going to happen anyways.
It's political dogma trumping reality.
Yeah.
And it costs lives and lots of lives as well. And, you know, I really don't know what the way around that is going to be, because, you know, we've got really right-wing governments in the UK, the United States, and, you know, I don't know how we're going to get around that. It doesn't seem like we're going to get around it anytime soon, which is tragic. And, you know, it's just so unnecessary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one other question I had coming up was, I'm sure through all of these, right, the term set and setting always come up. They're hallmarks of this space. And I know that whenever I'm venturing out, maybe on a forest walk or into a park, I always have a backpack with me, and it has like water, snacks, maybe a phone charger, stuff like this. And even if I never end up touching it throughout the course of the day, there's this sense of security that comes from, like, dude, if I have my bag, I can go through anything. I can get a cab back. Like, I can get lost. It doesn't matter. I have food. I have sunscreen. Like, I'm set. Like, my bag, it provides this foundation that just helps so much, even if it never gets used. And I was wondering if there was like a setup you had maybe at home, or if there were some core items that you would use when you were about to embark on something new.
I have, I make sure at the start I feel comfortable. You know, one of the things in there is largely the psychedelic. Are you feeling okay? And if you're not, don't do it. And that okay is not just physical. Am I ill? And you know, whatever. Am I mentally? Am I quite comfortable at the moment? Or am I really stressing out or something? You know, and if you are, then, you know, in a recreational scenario, don't as opposed to don't proceed. Wait until you're feeling okay. So I always make sure I'm quite happy before I have a psychedelic. Then a lot of it's dose dependent. You know, how far am I going to go on this occasion?
Mm-hmm.
Is it going to be a high dose? You know, if it's not going to be a high dose, generally I'm, you know, experienced enough to be okay. But I'm well aware it's and it does happen. You can go down the wrong, you know, start thinking about the wrong stuff, and so I'm always aware that, you know, there are things I can do to change that. And it's always this sort of, you know, as with the trauma, always remember you're having a drug experience.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to end. And you can, with psychedelics, certainly you can change the nature of the experience by doing so. Don't just sit there and go with the ride. You know, I've met people who've, oh, it was terrible. So what did you do? I was sat there for hours and oh, well, there you go. Why did you do that? Why did you sit there for hours going through that? As soon as I think I'm taking a wrong turn, I'll get up and go out, or I will turn on some music, or it doesn't really matter what, I'll just do something to break that chain of thought. And for me, that usually works. You know, I don't know what to keep still going back. I said, no, don't go back there. You know, it's a big it depends. You know, I mentioned earlier the mushroom. It was actually magic truffles in Amsterdam. I had a box of magic truffles. You know, I got to a museum, and it was a Dutch museum about a mile and a half away from the hotel I was staying in. And I had a really strong dose of this stuff, and I don't know why. But the classic sort of the walls were breathing, all the usual stuff started coming on as soon as I walked in the door. And then I walked down this corridor of these old 16th, 17th century Dutch masters, and they were all sort of red face, round faces. And before too long, they were looking like pigs. And not just pigs, they were looking like aggressive pigs. So I started getting scared. So I thought, okay, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to get out of here and I'm going to go somewhere that there aren't these scary pictures. They're only portraits, but, you know. So I got outside the museum and then it was a really hot day and it was really crowded. And the sound became so loud and it was just hard to sort of assimilate it all, and I was overwhelmed. So I was with someone, I had to say, oh, take me back to the hotel, I can't cope with this anymore. So again, it can be tricky. I mean, if I'm sat here somewhere that's a proper set and setting, that's planned, I find it really easy to just change the train of thought by doing something different. But in that scenario, I sort of went into the fire, you know, into the fire, from the saucepan into the fire, because you know outside it just became. Once I got to the hotel, I was perfectly okay. I closed my eyes, and it was the snaky things were out, but it was okay. So again, the certain setting is physical. You know, I would never ever suggest a heavy psychedelic experience in a city centre or anywhere busy, because you know, I had a pretty difficult time there. So it is subject to where you are, but I think a lot for me is just always remembering what it is you're doing. You know, don't get into it. So I know some things you can't help, but you know, certainly for drugs like LSD, always try and stay on top of it so you do know I'm on a trip. And I don't think that thought I'm on a trip for me tells me I'm in control of it to some degree and I can direct it.
Mm-hmm.
I try and explain that in the book. I don't know how to explain, that's what I mean anyway.
I feel like we're on the topic of harm reduction now, which I think is really important. And with high existence has been going quite a while, and we were one of the first websites to show the self-improvement aspects of certain psychedelics and drugs. And now we want to focus more on risk mitigation and safe use. So I think it's been like an amazing opportunity to speak to you, and I will be recommending your book 100%. It's going to be in our resources. But before we go into some steps that people can use into the Ten Commandments, you've talked about a few of your worst experiences. I was wondering if you could just say a couple of the absolute highlights in the creation of writing this book. What stands out to you as being like, wow, these were, and it doesn't have to be times you took drugs, it could be anything, but I'm just curious, what were the highlights for you?
I mean, I often get people saying, what was the best drug? And that's a really hard question, because the honest response is it depends on what I was looking for at the time. Mm-hmm. You know, so I sort of categorized them as you know, the best experience in terms of learning and long-term benefit. I'd probably say that was the ayahuasca and possibly San Pedro cactus, and then LSD in that order, probably, because it was just this stepping off the train, this different variety and rich experiences that you know, changed me as a person. And if I had to rank them against the other drugs, I'd still have those because I think psychedelics are the best drugs. If I had to rank them as classes. Mm-hmm. And not just because they tend to be more benign and safer than the other drugs, but because I think the experiences are richer than those of any other class of drug. If I'm looking for a physical high, if you like, a sort of energized, I'm feeling really good. Amphetamine, probably, speed as a stimulant. It does have the problem of the potential addiction. It does have the problem of the lag and the pain of the days that follow. But in terms of a body high, I really enjoyed that. Other mentions were probably be ephenidine. It's a dissociative. Now, I never really knew what a dissociative actually was. I just heard of ketamine, and I knew it was a horse tranquilizer. So before I actually approached this, I was, it's going to be a sedative. You know, why would I be interested in a sedative? Well, it can be a sedative, but it's actually not. In terms of its use as we would, recreational use as we would know it. I find with the experience to be really weird, as most people do, certainly when you start off, because it's like being disjointed from reality. Nothing's quite as it should be. Everything's sharp, your pictures, your vision's probably better than it normally is, but it's this sort of edge to it, and it's just slightly offset in some way, and everything's like that. You feel a bit numb, so you feel like floating around. So it's a really weird experience. But it's over so quickly. You know, ephenidine is a sort of, it's an oral dissociative, and it lasts some hours. And I've really, really enjoyed experiences with that. Just looking down the list, if there's any others that I'd, you know, they're the, I suppose, cannabis is quite pleasant. I think by and large, the best ones are the ones that have the lasting benefits rather than the short, isn't this wonderful in this very short-term euphoric type sense. You know, I'd definitely go for speed in that domain. But in terms of long-lasting, you know, I can have a psychedelic experience and I can be happy the following week because I've had it. Mm-hmm. Simply because it's sort of reset me in a way in some senses. And because I've sort of, you know, I've seen things a bit differently and I'm just feeling, you know, more fulfilled from it, from the experience. So, you know, without a doubt, they're the ones that, for me, are the most memorable and the happiest ones.
What are your thoughts on MDMA? Because there's a lot of, that's an interesting one because of the, I think it was just a breakthrough approved therapy by the FDA for PTSD. It's pretty reliable and it does have a kind of spiritual component in the kind of realm of compassion. It can be like, oh wow, this is possible, you know, you can actually be that open from your heart. What was your experience like with MDMA?
That was in some ways it's similar to the 2C's, psychedelic 2C drugs. It just has more empathy with it and less psychedelia. I enjoyed it. At a really high dose, and that was a sort of mistake, 220 milligrams, and I don't know why this has happened, but you know, the pills always used to be 80 or 100. And now, you know, certainly in this country, 200, 220, even higher. And that's not a good move, because people take a pill and it's a ridiculously high dose. And I had that, and it was the classic sort of high, really, in many respects, sort of warmth, happiness, empathy. I sweated a lot. I loved the world. So it's a very pleasant experience. There's absolutely no denying it. Mm-hmm. It does create a downer, a depression for a few days after. I think we call it in Holland Suicide Tuesday. Mm-hmm. Probably 48, 72 hours after the lack of serotonin. So it sucks serotonin. It's certainly fun. Therapeutic value, I can see that. I can see that, because it makes you, you know, certainly makes you non-depressed. You're very sort of, you know, you love everything, and everything you're looking at is nice. It's a sort of really lovely high. But I can't get my head around how it would be as medically useful as a psychedelic, because you never really leave this sort of, you just distort it, this sort of reality, if you like. But yeah, it's a very pleasing drug, but you know, something to watch with the dose, and be aware of the aftermath, which can be a bit rough.
Yeah, and the thing with MDMA is that, you know, people see that it's been approved as a breakthrough treatment for PTSD, but it's actually MDMA-assisted psychotherapy. You know, so it's not. So the therapy is a huge component.
It's got to be, hasn't it? Because it will enhance that sort of communication, because it opens you to. I can certainly see that. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think it's like, for people listening, it is like the two combined, and it's more with a strong psychedelic. It wouldn't be suitable often for a therapist to be talking to you during an experience like that. So it's
you don't need it. I mean, it's you're exploring, and you're sort of seeing things in a different way, and you know, nobody can add to that by talking to you about you. But you're absolutely right. That's got to be the, you know, with MDMA therapeutically, it opens you up, you know, to whoever you're with. I absolutely see how it could be used in therapy. It's a huge effect.
One of the tips that you've given in this conversation, which I love, is about not making more of the drug you're taking available to you, because obviously you should make the decision about how much you're going to take while you're sober, and not allow it to, you know, when you're on the drug, to be like, oh, I think I'm going to decide the dose now. It's probably not the best idea. What other safety protocols have been really useful to you as you wrote this book?
I sort of developed them as I went along, and I sort of put the generic ones at the front. As you've seen, this is the Ten Commandments. And I'll go through these, because I think it's worth sort of emphasizing them. And the first one is the research. You know, the first thing, you're thinking about taking a drug. Well, you know, almost goes without saying, you know, learn something about the drug. You know, what is it going to do to me, broadly speaking? You know, just try and find out the broad parameters of where you're going to be, you know, what people do when they're, you know, people do just, oh, what is it? It's this drug I've never heard of. I'll have it. Mm-hmm. Well, you just never, ever, ever, ever want to get into that sort of situation. The second one is source carefully. You know, this is where some people fall, is they buy something from an unknown source, an untrustworthy source, and they don't really know what it is. and they assume it's, say, MDMA, and it happens to be something completely different. You know, so don't just buy from the guy on the corner who you've never met. Take his word for it. Try and use a common sense. You know, you're going to put this thing in your body. You know, try and source from somewhere that you have at least a clue they are actually selling you the right thing. And that runs straight into test it. You know, when I started, I thought, I can't test the drug. You know, I'll just test it. You know, I've got a pill, I've got powder. You know, I just put it out of my mind. You know, it's not really necessary. Well, it is, and it's simple. Mm. You know, in this country and a lot of other countries, you can actually anonymously send a drug to an organization and they will test it and put the results on the internet.
Wow.
And the way it works, I did this with loads of them. The way it is, you go to the website, press start, and it will give you a unique code. That's your code. So you print the form off, you put it on the thing, then you put the details. They want to know, you know, what do you think it is? Nothing that breaches anonymity. And then you just send it off in the post. And then they'll put on the website the unique code for your form and what it actually is. And then they've done all the tests. So, you know, if you're certainly that is a readiness in the UK, but there's similar organisations elsewhere. You know, it takes a few days. You know, and it's worth it because then you know exactly what you're taking and it's free. Okay, so that's one possible way of testing it. If you can't do that, or if there aren't any facilities in your country, buy a test kit. You know, I thought, buy a test kit, because that's going to be difficult. I'm not a chemist, you know, I've not even got, you know, I've never done chemistry. So I bought, first of all, there's a simple one test kit. You just drop a bit in a test tube that you break it off, drop it in, it turns a colour, it tells you what it is. If you want more sophistication, you know, reagent tests, you get three different ones and you try the different colours and you know with more surety what this drug is. It's not difficult to do. You just sit down and just pour some liquid onto your substance, a tiny little bit of your substance. It will turn a colour that will give you information about what this drug is. So you can test it. And that's got to be if you can't get it to test service, that's got to be a good idea. Number four is scales, weigh it. You know, a number of people who I've made mistakes and I've suffered because I've eyeballed certain drugs, some stimulants, research chemicals. I've had terrible times because I haven't weighed them properly. So sit down, buy a pair of scales. You know, they're not expensive. $20, $30. I think mine were £15 for a set of scales, which I've still got, and they're pretty reliable. And use them, they're easy to use. So weigh your drugs. Don't just try and eyeball the dose because you'll get it wrong. Number five, properly and rationally consider the dose of regard for your circumstances and all the information you've accumulated so far. This is a good one. Always remember you can take more, but not less. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I do allergy check if I've never had the drug before. It's a tiny bit on my tongue because if you're allergic to it, you'll know about it. Mm-hmm. And then I have a small dose. You know, I don't go in full heavy dose, and if I'm okay, then there's nothing terribly wrong, then I'll have a pretty high dose. But you know, you can always take more, but you can't take less is almost a mantra. Number six is the allergy test, which just come in. Number seven, I've mentioned earlier, are you feeling okay today? It's a serious question. If you're unwell, sick or in poor health, those conditions may be amplified during the experience and may have serious implications with respect to body load. So a lot of drugs have body load. Body load is where it makes you feel not very well in some way or another. If in doubt, don't proceed. And it applies to mental health as well. You know, in the psychedelic space, if you really depressed, it can intensify that if you're not careful. So don't proceed if you're not, on at a decent level in your game. Plan the experience in its parameters so that you don't take rash decisions under the influence. And this is where you've only got available what you choose to take. Having taken whatever dose you have chosen, be patient and jump to the conclusion it didn't work. Common mistake is to double dose, yeah. Carefully consider set and setting. Afterhand, water, food, or whatever provisions or entertainment you're going to need. Now, water is important for a lot of drugs. MDMA is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to need access to water. There are clubs, not in this country, I don't think, where they don't allow access to water. You have to buy a drink. Mm-hmm. That's just asking for a mess, isn't it? So, you make sure you've got a responsibility to make sure you have access to what you're going to need during the course of your experience. So, plan it accordingly. For all psychedelics, bear in mind that your judgment and functionality may be severely impaired, which could be a significant factor if you're likely to find yourself in a public place. So that's part of the setting. Now, here's an interesting one that I actually came across. Somebody told me that this should be in before I even got halfway through the book. Have contact details of help services to hand in case of urgent need. That sounds obvious, but I never did it. I'm taking a drug or perhaps a drug I've never had. If it goes wrong and I realise I need to go to hospital or I need a doctor, I need medical services or help, the last thing I want to be doing is thinking, oh, what do I do now? You want it to hand. You want to be, oh, right, here it is. I ring this number or I call this person. So have that sort of information available on your body if you're going out before you start. And if you're in a group, obviously try to find someone to abstain. And it's interesting. Give your body plenty of time to recover and your mind due time to assimilate the experience. In other words, if you're a regular drug user, take a break between psychoactive sessions and a long break between sessions using substances from the same class. And I even provide a little sort of calendar thing to show you how I did it when I was doing this. And I just sort of think, well, okay, well, I might have to drink on Friday night. What am I going to do next Friday if I go out or the weekend after? I sort of just try and plan it to sort of keep drugs of the same class apart in particular. Because that's largely how people do get addicted. They have the same drug again and again and again. And it's, you really don't want it. A, you're not enjoying the drug itself to its full capacity if you're doing it that way. But B, you just really are asking to become addicted or dependent in some way if that's what you're doing, unless there's a big gap between them.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're one of these people, and there are a lot of people who must have a drug every week or two days a week or even every few days, if you really are in that situation, maybe you should be thinking you need to get some help. But apart from that, that rule does apply in particular. Use different classes of drugs if you're a multi-drug user, rather than I've got this supply of cocaine at the moment, so I'll go through this. No, don't go through this. Make it spin out a long time and use something else if you must have a drink in a few days instead, or something else, some other less benign drug or whatever. So I'll be very, very careful in this area and try and plan it if you're in that scenario.
Wow, those are invaluable. I think we're going to do an article that goes along with this interview. And we'll put the bullet points that you listed in there as well.
If you want, just take the Ten Commandments out, put them in. That's fine. I mean, those commandments are so important.
Mm.
You know, we can't do the individual drugs, which have got the details of it, but the commandments are sort of general. There's a general procedure which will, you know, dramatically mitigate risk if you actually apply them all. So, you know, copy paste them out and put them in if you want to. It's up to you how you want to do it, but they're available to you if you want them.
Yeah, well, definitely, I appreciate that, and I have a feeling that that for some reason that we will continue a relationship with you and keep getting information from you and asking questions and so forth and publishing more articles on this work, because it's a staggering achievement.
I'll talk anytime. Actually really, really good. It's fantastic, and you've been around for a long, long time, because I was reading your platform right at the beginning. before I did the ayahuasca, in fact.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, I feel some synchronicity in this situation for sure. I'm wondering what you're up to since you've published the book. Like, what is taking up your time now? What are you thinking about? Just curious.
I'm still traveling. I mean, I've tried to revisit some of the. I went to in November. I went to India to have cannabis edibles, a drink called Banglassi. It's in the book. You know, this was just last November, and a bit in the Varanasi is the epicenter of Shiva country, which means it's legal. It's part of the religion, part of Hinduism. So I went to have it there, and I still travel usually half a dozen times a year, four, five, six times a year, to different places to try and experience some of these in a more authentic setting than I originally had them. So I'm still interested in it, very much so. I've started collating the photographs because, I was mentioning it to Eric earlier on. This has got a photograph of all the drugs in it, but it's black and white. And one of the thoughts I had was, I've got thousands of photographs, not just of the drugs, colour photographs. I've got photographs of all these drug-related places I've been to, photographs of drug paraphernalia, photographs of, you know, you know, if it's anything to do with the coffee shops, photographs of coffee shop menus, and anything to do with the drug world, I've got photographs of it. Photographs of the inside of infamous prisons, where it'd be famous, you know, Chappelle Corbin, the Bali Nine had been locked up and things like that. I thought, well, what would be interesting is if I put those in some sort of Kindle edition book, so that people who got this book can actually look at the picture and think, oh, okay, that's what heroin looks like. And then actually go and get the picture from the sort of Kindle edition of this photograph album, zoom in ultra fine detail and actually have a proper look at the drug itself. So that's in my mind. And I realise there'll be many hundreds of pictures in there, and it'll embrace the entire drug cannabis. So I've been busy on that, really, which is a sort of supplement to support this.
Yeah,
we're sort of generally interested in the scene, and it can be used as a sort of also a reminder, you know, don't skip safety measures, go back to this book.
So, I really like that, and I think that two things we've been discussing in this conversation, but two things come up for me when I read the Drug User's Bible, and that is, it's a book full of incredibly important information, but I'm also curious about how it was made, you know, like the journey that the person who wrote this went on. And I think there are like two separate kind of tracks that I want to go into. So I really think that the supporting material that you're
creating. It does tell a story of the journey.
Yeah.
And then certainly the sort of words are like sort of experiences on that journey, without a shadow of a doubt. And it's a journey I was compelled to do. Did I enjoy the journey? Yeah. But it was driven by the sort of fulfillment of a sort of task, really, actually finishing it, and believing that it's valuable and useful and makes a contribution. So, you know, I've enjoyed doing it for that reason, because I always felt it was going to be valuable. And I wrote at the front of this Save One Life, the entire journey has been worth the effort and the cost. I think it probably has. So, you know, I'm really, really pleased I did it.
Well, I'm really honored to be sort of sharing your work with people. I have no doubt that many thousands will be exposed to your work through High Existence. And I would imagine that it could potentially save lives as well. And just generally create like more good information, which is also super important. So thank you for taking the time to chat with us. Really enjoyed talking with you. Appreciate it.
If you enjoyed this podcast, I hope you did, then would love it if you left a review, shared it with your friends, left a comment, give it a rating, any of that stuff. That would really help us to keep getting great guests. It would really help us with the podcast and keep doing what we love and keep giving you good things to think about and new perspectives that are helpful. See you in the next episode.